A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
So yesterday, footage started circulating of an Iranian ballistic missile hitting Muwaffaq Salty Air Base in Jordan, and it's the kind of video that makes you stop scrolling. But the question Daniel sent us isn't really about the strike itself. It's about why that base exists in the first place. Why does the U.S. operate roughly 30 major bases across the Middle East, spread across countries that often don't get along with each other? You've got bases in Israel, in Jordan, in Qatar, in the UAE, all within a few hundred miles of each other. Why not just consolidate into one or two super bases in friendly territory? What's the doctrine that makes a network necessary rather than redundant?
And the timing of Daniel's question is exactly right, because this isn't the first time Iran has struck that base in this cycle, but it is the first time they've hit Jordanian soil with ballistic missiles. That changes the strategic calculus in a way we should unpack. So let's start with the most obvious layer, geography. Muwaffaq Salty sits about 60 miles from the Syrian border and roughly the same from Iraq. That is not an accident.
60 miles is basically the driveway.
It's close enough that a drone launched from eastern Syria can be tracked from the moment it leaves the ground. And here's the thing about missile defense. It's not just about having the interceptors. It's about having radar coverage that can see the launch early enough to calculate a trajectory. A Patriot battery at Al Udeid in Qatar cannot see a missile launched from western Iraq. The curvature of the earth literally gets in the way. So you need forward radar nodes, and Muwaffaq Salty is positioned to cover the exact corridor where Iranian-backed militias have been operating for a decade.
So the first order answer is that missile defense is a geometry problem, and the geometry demands distributed nodes. But that can't be the whole story, because if it were just about radar coverage, you'd put unmanned sensor stations out there. You wouldn't need a full airbase with personnel and runways and a status of forces agreement negotiated with the Jordanian monarchy.
Right, and that's where the doctrine gets interesting. The U.S. doesn't just need sensor coverage, it needs access. And access means different things in different countries. Let me walk through this concretely. Qatar hosts Al Udeid, which is the largest pre-positioned stockpile of U.S. military equipment in the region. We're talking about warehouses full of munitions, spare parts, vehicles, the logistical backbone that makes sustained operations possible. But Qatar's airspace is on the Gulf side of the Arabian Peninsula. If you're flying strike aircraft into Syria, you need overflight rights through either Saudi Arabia or Jordan. Saudi airspace has been politically complicated at various points. Jordan has consistently granted those overflight rights.
So you need Qatar for the warehouse, and Jordan for the hallway.
And you need the UAE for something else entirely. Al Dafra Air Base in the Emirates hosts F-35 squadrons and KC-135 refueling tankers. The tankers are critical because strike aircraft burn through fuel quickly when they're carrying a full payload. They need to top off mid-route. The UAE's position on the southern Gulf means tankers can orbit safely and refuel aircraft heading north. No single country in the region provides all three of those capabilities simultaneously, not because they lack the physical space, but because their domestic politics won't allow it.
So, if I'm hearing you correctly, this is almost like a supply chain where each node specializes in a different function. But what happens when one of those functions gets blocked? If Jordan suddenly said no more overflight rights, do we have a backup hallway?
We do, but it's a worse hallway. You could route strike aircraft through Turkish airspace, but that adds significant flight time and requires yet another set of diplomatic clearances. And Turkey's relationship with U.S. Operations in Syria has been, let's say, complicated. You could try to go through Iraqi airspace, but that introduces its own sovereignty issues and potentially exposes your flight paths to the very militias you're trying to strike. So yes, alternatives exist, but they're all slower, more diplomatically fragile, or operationally riskier. That's the whole logic of the network. You're not just collecting nodes, you're collecting options, and the options have different price tags.
This is the part I think most coverage misses. The network isn't a logistical inefficiency. It's a political necessity. Each host nation has its own red lines about what the U.S. can and cannot do from its territory. And those red lines are different in every country.
Let's get specific about Jordan, because Muwafaq Salty is the case study that makes this visible. Jordan's Status of Forces Agreement, the legal document that governs what U.S. forces can and cannot do, is unusually restrictive. It prohibits launching combat operations from Jordanian soil without explicit approval from the king. Not the prime minister, not the defense ministry, the monarch personally. That's a much tighter leash than what exists in Qatar or the UAE.
And yet, the U.S. keeps the base there and keeps investing in it. So the restriction isn't a bug. It's part of why the arrangement works for both sides. Jordan gets to tell its population that American combat missions aren't being launched from their territory, which is domestically essential for the Hashemite monarchy. The U.S. gets a forward intelligence and surveillance node that doesn't need to launch combat missions to be valuable.
Muwafaq Salty was originally built in 2002 as a logistics hub for the Iraq War. By 2015, it had evolved into a key intelligence and drone base. Its location allows monitoring of the Syrian border and provides support for the Al-Tanf garrison, that small U.S. outpost in southeastern Syria near the Jordanian and Iraqi borders. The base's value is in what it can see and what it can enable, not in what it launches, and that's precisely why Iran struck it.
Let's sit with that for a second, because the target selection tells us something. Iran didn't hit Al Udeid in Qatar, which is a much larger base with far more equipment. They hit the forward node in Jordan. Why?
Two reasons, and they both connect back to Daniel's question about why the network exists across multiple countries. First, Muwafaq Salty is the most exposed node. It's the closest to Iranian proxy forces in Syria and Iraq, which means it's the easiest to strike with the ballistic missiles Iran has been supplying to those groups. Second, and more strategically, hitting a base in Jordan creates a different kind of political pressure than hitting a base in Qatar.
Because Jordan has a peace treaty with Israel and a long border with the West Bank. The Hashemite monarchy's domestic legitimacy is tied in part to its relationship with the Palestinian population. A majority of Jordanians are of Palestinian origin. When the Gaza War escalated in 2024, Jordan saw massive street protests. The government threatened to revoke U.S. basing rights. That threat was real, and it was public.
And that's the second-order dynamic that makes the network both a strength and a vulnerability. The U.S. spreads its assets across multiple countries so that no single host nation can hold the entire operation hostage. If Jordan revokes basing rights, the U.S. still has Al Udeid and Al Dafra and Incirlik in Turkey. The mission degrades, but it doesn't collapse. That redundancy is the whole point.
But the flip side, and this is what Iran is exploiting right now, is that every base is also a political pressure point. A strike on Jordanian soil doesn't just damage U.S. equipment. It puts the Jordanian government in an impossible position domestically. The monarchy has to explain to its citizens why American bases on their territory are drawing Iranian missiles onto Jordanian soil. That conversation is politically toxic.
And that's different from a strike on Al Udeid. Qatar is a tiny, wealthy Gulf state with a small citizen population and a massive expatriate workforce. The domestic political pressure there is fundamentally different. The Qatari leadership doesn't face the same kind of street-level accountability that a constitutional monarchy like Jordan does. Iran knows this. They're not just picking targets based on military value. They're picking targets based on the political fracture lines in each host nation.
So they're reading the domestic politics of each host nation and calibrating which node to hit based on where the political reverberations will be loudest. That's a level of sophistication that I don't think gets enough attention. It's not random target selection. It's target selection designed to maximize the host government's discomfort.
And they've had years to study this. Iranian intelligence watches Jordanian domestic politics closely. They see the protest cycles. They track public opinion on the Palestinian issue. They understand the monarchy's vulnerability on this specific question. So when they choose to put a missile into Muwafaq Salty rather than, say, a base in Bahrain where the ruling family has far more coercive control over public dissent, they're making a deliberate calculation about where the political damage will be greatest.
So we've got two layers now. Layer 1 is geographic coverage, radar arcs and overflight corridors. Layer 2 is the sovereignty bargain, each host nation's specific restrictions and the political management that comes with them. What's Layer 3?
Layer 3 is what I'd call the hostage dynamic, but let me frame it more precisely. Host nations use the base as leverage over the United States, not just the other way around. Jordan has threatened to revoke basing rights multiple times, most recently in 2024 during those Gaza protests. When they make that threat, they're saying, manage your regional policy in a way that doesn't make our domestic position untenable, or will take away something you value.
And the U.S. has to listen, because losing Muwafaq Salty would create a genuine capability gap. You can't just pick up the intelligence infrastructure and move it to Qatar overnight. The radar coverage doesn't work from there. The drone flight times to the Syrian border get longer. The whole architecture degrades.
This is why the network exists instead of a single superbase. If the U.S. consolidated everything at Al Udeid, the Qatari government would have enormous leverage over American military operations across the entire region. Every policy disagreement would become a hostage negotiation. By spreading assets across Jordan, Qatar, the UAE, Bahrain, Kuwait, and Turkey, the U.S. ensures that no single host nation can dictate terms. Each one can make things difficult, but none can make things impossible.
There's an irony here that's worth naming. The network was built to give the U.S. maximum flexibility. Don't like the political constraints in one country? Shift operations to another. But in practice, the network also creates maximum surface area for political pressure. Iran can strike any node and create a crisis for the host government. The more nodes, the more opportunities for that kind of strike.
And that brings us to the current moment. Iran struck Jordan specifically because Jordan is the most politically vulnerable host in the network. The Hashemite monarchy is caught between its security relationship with the United States and its need to maintain legitimacy with a population that is deeply sympathetic to the Palestinian cause. Every missile that lands on Jordanian soil makes that balancing act harder. Iran's goal isn't to destroy the base. They can't do that with the missiles they have. It's to make the political cost of hosting the base higher than the strategic benefit.
Which is a classic asymmetric strategy. You don't defeat the military asset. You defeat the political arrangement that sustains it.
And this is where the comparison to Europe is instructive. U.S. basing in Europe operates under the NATO framework. There's a multilateral security architecture, standardized agreements, collective defense commitments. If Russia strikes a U.S. SEST base in Germany, that's an attack on the alliance. The political fallout is shared across 30-plus member states. In the Middle East, every basing arrangement is bilateral. There's no collective security framework. If Iran strikes a base in Jordan, it's a Jordanian problem and an American problem. The Emiratis and the Qataris are not obligated to respond.
So the Middle East network is more fragile by design. It's a patchwork of bilateral deals rather than a unified architecture. That gives the USO more flexibility in some ways. You can tailor each agreement to the specific host nation, but it also means each node has to be managed individually. There's no alliance machinery to absorb the shock.
And this connects to something Daniel was getting at in his question. He noted that the countries hosting these bases are often not on the best of terms with each other. That's not a coincidence. The U.S. is operating in a region where the host nations have their own rivalries. Qatar and the UAE were on opposite sides of a diplomatic crisis just a few years ago. Saudi Arabia and Turkey have had serious tensions. Jordan and the Gulf states have different political systems and different threat perceptions.
So the U.S. is essentially arbitraging those rivalries. If Qatar and the UAE both want a U.S. presence, they compete for American attention and neither can afford to be too demanding. The network leverages intra-regional competition to keep basing rights affordable.
Affordable in diplomatic terms, at least. The financial cost is enormous. Maintaining 30-plus bases across multiple countries with different legal frameworks, different supply chains, different force protection requirements. But the alternative, consolidating into one or two countries and handing those hosts enormous leverage is strategically worse.
I want to pause on that financial dimension for a second, because I think it's easy to hear 30 bases and assume it's just waste. But is there actually an efficiency argument for the distributed model? Or is this purely strategic spending that we accept as the price of access?
There's a counterintuitive efficiency argument, actually. When you have a single superbase, you're paying whatever the host nation demands because you have no alternative. Monopoly pricing applies to basing rights just like it applies to everything else. When you have 30 bases across 10 countries, each host knows you can walk away. That competition suppresses the cost of each individual agreement. So the total bill might be higher because you're maintaining more physical infrastructure, but the per-base cost is lower than it would be if any single host had you over a barrel. Whether that nets out as cheaper overall is debatable, but it's not as simple as consolidation would save money.
You're trading infrastructure duplication costs for negotiating leverage. Let's bring this back to the footage from yesterday. When you see that video of a ballistic missile hitting Muwafaq Salty, what you're actually watching is a strike on the political architecture of the network, not just the physical base. The missile hit a runway and some support facilities. The military impact is minor. The political impact on Jordan's willingness to keep hosting that base is the real payload.
And that's the lens Daniel should apply when he's following the story. The question isn't just which base was hit. The question is, which host nation is now under domestic pressure, and how does that change the U.S.? Position in the network? If Jordan starts restricting operations at Muwafaq Salty in response to public pressure, the U.S. loses its forward sensor node on the Syrian border. That doesn't end the mission, but it degrades it in a specific way that no other base can fully compensate for.
Which is exactly why the network exists in the first place, so that degradation at one node doesn't mean mission failure, but it's also why the network is a permanent management challenge. You're constantly tending to the political health of each host relationship, and a crisis anywhere in the region can destabilize multiple nodes simultaneously.
There's one more dimension here that I think is worth pulling out, and it connects to the future of the network. The distributed model works as deterrence against a single knockout blow. Iran can't neutralize US. Air power with one strike because the assets are spread across 10 plus countries. But that logic assumes the adversary can only strike a few targets. As Iran's ballistic missile arsenal gets more precise and more numerous, the calculus shifts.
If every base is within range, redundancy starts to lose its value. You can't deter a barrage by spreading out, if the barrage can hit all your spread points simultaneously.
Right. And that's the open question hanging over the whole architecture. The network was built for a world where the primary threat was terrorism or limited conventional attack. Scenarios where geographic distribution genuinely reduced risk. Against a state actor with hundreds of precision-guided ballistic missiles, distribution might just mean more targets to defend rather than fewer points of failure.
So the next administration, whoever that is going to face a real dilemma. Do you consolidate into fewer, more heavily defended hubs, accepting that this gives the host nation more leverage? Or do you maintain the distributed network and accept that every node is a potential pressure point that an adversary can strike?
And consolidation isn't just a military decision. It would require renegotiating every single status of forces agreement, if you're Jordan and the U.S. Once to pull back from Muwafaq Salty, you lose the aid package and the strategic relationship that comes with hosting the base. Jordan doesn't want that. Qatar doesn't want to be the sole host either, because that makes them the sole target. The host nations have their own interest in maintaining the distributed model.
So everyone is locked into a system that nobody would design from scratch today, but nobody can afford to dismantle.
That's the empire of bases in one sentence.
All right, so if I'm a listener trying to follow this story intelligently, and I think this is what Daniel was really asking for, what's the mental model? When you see news of a strike on a US base in the region, what should you be asking?
Two questions. First, what unique capability does this specific base provide that no other base in the network can fully replace? Is it radar coverage? Overflight rights? Pre-positioned munitions? Intelligence collection? The answer tells you what operational gap the strike is trying to create. Second, how is the host government's domestic position affected? Is the strike creating political pressure on the leadership to distance itself from the United States? The answer there tells you whether the strike is actually succeeding strategically, regardless of the physical damage.
And most news coverage will give you the casualty count and the crater size. Those are the least important variables. The crater gets filled in. The political fracture is what lasts.
If you track those two variables, capability gap, and host nation pressure, you'll understand more about the conflict than 90% of the punditry. The network is a political structure as much as a military one. Iran understands that. The question is whether the American public understands it.
Daniel's question was about the doctrine, and I think the doctrine boils down to this. The U.S. operates a network instead of a fortress because no single country in the Middle East is willing or able to be the fortress. The network is a workaround for the region's political fragmentation. It's clever, it's expensive, and it's fragile in ways that are only becoming visible now that it's being tested under fire.
And the test isn't over. The strike yesterday was the latest in a pattern, not an isolated event. The network will keep being tested, and the weak points will keep shifting depending on which host nation is under the most domestic pressure at any given moment. That's the story to watch.
One more thing before we wrap. There's a misconception I want to name directly, because it shapes how people interpret these strikes. The assumption is that host nations are passive. They're just landlords collecting rent in the form of aid packages, and the US does whatever it wants from their territory. That's not how it works. The Jordanians have real leverage. They've used it. The Emiratis have real leverage. The Qataris have real leverage. The network exists because the US has to negotiate access constantly, and the terms of that negotiation are different in every capital.
And those terms can change overnight. A protest movement, a parliamentary election, a royal succession. Any of those can shift the domestic calculus for a host government, which in turn shifts what the U.S. can do from that base. The network is not a fixed asset. It's a living set of relationships that requires constant maintenance.
So when you see that footage from Muwafaq Salty, you're not just seeing a missile hit a base. You're seeing a move in a much larger game. A game about who hosts what, under what terms, and at what political cost. That's the doctrine. That's why the network exists across countries that don't like each other, and that's why understanding it requires looking past the explosions to the political architecture underneath.
Well said. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The platypus detects prey underwater using electrolocation through its bill, which contains roughly 40,000 electroreceptors. When a platypus closes its eyes, ears, and nostrils during a dive, the bill effectively functions as a camera that sees electric fields, converting the faint electrical impulses of a shrimp's muscles into an optical map of the riverbed. This mechanism was first described in detail during the interwar period, and a related species of electroreceptive fish was cataloged in Guyana.
A camera that sees electricity on a duck beaver's face.
Nature is not subtle. Thanks, Hilbert.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you want more episodes, find us at myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. Until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.